and welcome to episode 155 of Speak Beastie for July 11th, 2022. I'm Amy.
I'm Anne.
And we'll have another person here in just a few minutes.
Right now, it's just us. We'll do our best to keep you entertained. Well, speaking of folks who keep us entertained, this episode is sponsored by our Speak Beastie Patreon supporter, Catherine, who is our editor.
Yay, Catherine. We love you. Thank you for putting up with us.
The absolute queen.
You make us sound so good.
She makes us sound smart. I had to edit some of my own Patreon content, and I realized how many times I, like, click my tongue or say, and I had, like, every time I had to edit one of those out, I was like, God, I sound so dumb. Mm-hmm. But Catherine makes me sound like a genius.
Isn't it amazing the things that you pick up on that you say constantly all the time, and you're like, why do I talk like that?
Yes!
Mine is I always, like, I'll end a sentence with the question, right? With a question mark at the end. I'm like, listening to myself, I'm like, why am I always asking people for affirmation?
Something, something, socialization of women, something, something.
Right? I'm going to try so hard to break that habit this year. That's my goal this summer.
That's a really good resolution, is to be more assertive in how you speak and not have to ask for validation from others around you.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. It's a good resolution for 2022.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Anyway.
Some good news.
Yes. Going into the Phoenix Register.
And now a message from our sponsors.
Hey you, yes you, the magical cats and dolls waving your wands like bean shooters in a caper. Looking to be on the up and up about Newt Scamander, famous zoologist and world traveler? No need for gossip at the juice joint, just tune your ears to Speak Beastie. And now for as little as one dragon dollar a month, you can make Speak Beastie the Neasles Meow. Support the show at patreon.com and suddenly you're the big cheese, the real McCoy, with exclusive access to swell sneak peeks, bloopers, and behind-the-scenes features. But wait, there's more. Sponsors can also beat their gums at the joint with access to the Speak Beastie Common Room on Facebook. Now you're really on the clean sweep, flyboy. Get a wiggle on to patreon.com/speakbeastie to learn more about becoming a sponsor today. It's the Billy Wigs knees and how.
There was a teaser trailer that was released for Hogwarts Legacy. It's on the Hogwarts Legacy Twitter feed. And it reveals some potential locations. There's like a house carved into a cliff by the sea and a tree that's surrounded by some kind of flying creature, like butterflies or birds. It's gorgeous, like unbelievably gorgeous. It looks like a movie.
It just makes me so excited for this game.
Yes. And like the fact that it's going to be on Switch too makes me very happy because I was not looking to buy a PS5 just for this game.
Like, I'm really not a gamer, but I'm so excited to play this.
Yeah, same. I love a good open world game. I would also not call myself a gamer by any stretch of the imagination, because as I've said before on multiple podcasts, my gaming pretty much begins and ends with Stardew Valley and The Sims. But this looks amazing. Additionally, in other Hogwarts Legacy news, some pre-order bonuses may have leaked. We're not going to get too much into them because it's a leak. But the one that is relevant to our podcast is that one of the potential pre-order bonus is a Thestral mount. That is a Thestral that you can ride. It is your friend.
Ooh.
All of my dreams are coming true. In addition, this will be old hat by the time this episode actually comes out. But we are recording prior to, I think actually the DVD comes out on June 28th, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so this is
tomorrow from the day that we're recording.
Yeah, so this is, like I said, this is going to be old hat by the day that this actually drops. But as of right now, this is at least news to me. I don't know about you. I don't know if you've been looking into special features and stuff, but apparently a list of them has been released. And If you don't want to know, you're going to know. This episode's coming out in 2 weeks. Whatever. So the special features that are potentially, again, nothing. I can't find anything confirming this. This is just from highdefdigest.com. So may or may not be completely accurate, but the ones that were listed on the website were the Dumbledore family tree, Dumbledore through the ages, magical or muggle, the magic of Hogwarts, even more Fantastic Beasts, Newt in the Wild, the German Ministry of Magic, a Dumbledore duel, the Candidate's Dinner, Erkstag Jailbreak, Battle in Bhutan, the Secrets of Cursed Child, and deleted scenes. Any thoughts about any of those?
Newt in the Wild sounds interesting. What's this about?
I hope it is just like a 10-minute short where he goes around and is just crocodile hunter with his collapsible teapot in the in the jungle.
Yes. And then the Erkstag Jailbreak. I really hope, I've talked before about how this scene just keeps going on and on, which makes it even more hilarious to me. I hope that this is like a ridiculously long extended scene of that. So it's like, like a 20-minute Erkstag Jailbreak scene.
Please. Just like, and at least half of it is just Theseus trying to dance with the baby manticores.
Yeah, maybe Newt has to like physically grab Theseus's hands to show him the correct way to move them. He's like, you know, prompting him to turn out his toes more. It's going to be,
that's what
I hope this is.
Please.
It's interesting that there's a Secrets of Cursed Child special. Like,
I admit it, I have not seen Cursed Child, so maybe there is a Fantastic Beasts connection in there that
I have
missed. Or maybe they are going to be like, well, you see, this background extra is actually this background extra, the Goblet of Fire scene.
Yeah, I'm confused why you would put Cursed Child content on this,
I don't know.
Okay.
I guess they're just, they're like, well, we have this neat featurette. Let's put it on the Fantastic Beasts DVD. Why not?
Yeah. I'm very excited to see deleted scenes, though. I think that will be really good.
Yeah, I can't, it might be in the Owl Post that they talk about some potential deleted scenes. Yes, some of our Owl Posts. So we'll get into that. But I'm excited to see them too, because you know there had to be so much left on the cutting room floor of this movie.
Yeah, and I think they'll probably answer some of our questions and make things a little bit clearer.
Yeah, hopefully between the deleted scenes we'll be getting and the screenplay, we'll actually be able to put together a coherent timeline for the movie and a cohesive plot.
Yeah.
Further DVD news, there is going to be a Walmart-exclusive gift box that comes in a case and appears to include some prop replicas. I could not find a listing, but if you look on Walmart.com on the website, it looks like there's a Great Wizarding Express ticket, a copy of Newt's notebook, and one other book. I couldn't really make out what it was. So that's pretty cool. It looks like that's reselling, I think, for $35.
Yeah. I really like this, like, art book thing. I think that's pretty cool. It's got the artwork of the creatures in it.
Yeah. That's the Target art edition that includes a 16-page replica of Newt's notebook. I'm not sure if it's the same one that's also in the Walmart exclusive, but it is. It does look gorgeous.
I was thinking they both had the same one. Yeah, I think right.
I'm not sure. They might.
The Target one.
Yeah, Target has just the notebook. And then the Walmart edition has the notebook and some other stuff, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this is just me, like, on Walmart, the mobile version of Walmart.com, which is not great, zooming in, trying to figure out what is included with the special Gox edition.
Oh.
And the Target one retails for $27.99. So, again, this will all be old hat by the time this episode comes out, and you will all be like, all of us have had this DVD for 2 weeks now. We've broken it with how many times we watched it. Why are you still talking about it? But it is news right now. All right, so that wraps up the Phoenix Register.
Okay, and we're just going to keep the birds right on coming with Owl Post. We've got some great Owl Posts this week, so thank you so much for sending in your thoughts. The first owl post we have is from Diskid, who submitted via our website, speakbc.com. Diskid says, I have to agree, I want confirmation as to what juicy means in regards to Tina and Lolly's friendship. It very well could mean some sort of past intimacy, but at the very least, it means there is some sort of deep secret there. Maybe they both got involved in something they're keeping secret during their school years, like stumbled onto something dark, made an amazing discovery they are keeping to themselves, or maybe they made some sort of unbreakable vow in the past. That's probably what I'm most looking forward to learning about Lolly. Clearly, there is something very interesting in her past years with Tina, and I want to know what it is. You cannot tell us fans it's juicy and keep it a secret forever, lol. I hope, even if they don't do another movie, that somebody tells us what it is at the very least.
Oh, yeah, I love that.
I know, like, we need to know.
Maybe they found something, like, spooky in the Ilvermorny basement or something.
Yeah. Or, it'd be kind of cool if this was kind of a parallel to Newt and Lita's situation, right? Maybe something happened at school that wasn't supposed to happen that kind of got them into trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, like, took the fall for the other, defended the other, and they were both in on it. That'd be kind of fun to, like, parallel it on the two sides with Newt and Tina.
Yeah. None of these scenarios are incompatible with them also being girlfriends.
Yeah.
Which is great. They made a discovery. It
could
love.
Be one or the other or all of the above.
This is, I love, I hope, I'm with you, this kid. I hope we do find out what juicy means. It's so, like, it's such a intriguing word.
Yeah. I want the backstory here.
Yes. Big agree.
All right, our second owl comes from Jerry, also via the website speakbc.com. And Jerry says, this is an owl post for you from a 65-year-old Hufflepuff.
Oh my God!
We're so happy you listen to this show, Jerry. Hufflepuff to Hufflepuff, thank you. Jerry says, I enjoyed episode 154. You finally provided an explanation for why the screenplay won't be released until July. The publication date was set back when the movie wasn't to be released until July, and someone wasn't able to / didn't adjust the publication when the movie release date was moved to April. The movie Magic Book does provide some hints. It does make it sound like the early 1930s was the intended date, though I could not find any exact date given. I am going to assume the 1932 date you seem to settle on in episode 154. They had a two-page spread titled The Candidates' Banners, but only show actual banners for Grindelwald and Santos. They do mention that Tau's banner are on bamboo poles instead of sticks, but no information about content. I have been trying to discover how many deleted scenes will be available on the DVD/Blu-ray release. I found some deleted scenes on YouTube, and they include a wonderful scene, wonderful's all caps, where Theseus seems to have been sent by Dumbledore to Newt's home to help nurse him back to health after the killing of the mother, Chilin, and associated fighting. Oh, interesting.
Oh, that is wonderful, all caps.
I haven't seen that one yet. Now I need to go Google it. Great brotherly bonding, and funny, too. One of my favorite scenes from the movie, and they didn't even include it. Theseus plays with the baby Chilin.
Oh my God, my heart!
Aw. By the way, the movie Magic Book states that for the cue to bow, you must be both pure of heart and also have leadership skills, which to me explains why the cue enjoyed Jacob and Newt and some others, but didn't bow to them. They would not be good leaders for various reasons. You folks have a very enjoyable podcast.
Thank you, Jerry! Oh my God, this is so... I love this. Everything about this.
I love it when we get owl post from someone, like, for the first time. It just makes me so happy hearing from someone, you know, that felt the need to communicate with us. That's such a cool thing. I love all of this.
Yeah, I didn't even think the deleted scenes would be available on YouTube.
Yeah.
But now I'm going to have a look. Because I need to see my husband playing with the Chilin. Like, I need to see it.
And yeah, like Jerry says, that movie Magic Book actually has a lot of really great snippets in it. I got it for my birthday, and I'm still kind of working my way through it, but there's some really good stuff in there.
Nice. I might have to finally give in and pick it up. It sounds like there's so much information on there. It sounds like it's going to answer a lot of my questions.
There really is. And just for anyone who's into the behind the scenes stuff, there's some really great like character illustrations and concept art and stuff in there.
Nice. Well, if I get Chris to drive me out to, now I can say past guest, Chris. I can get him to drive me out to Walmart tomorrow to get that Walmart exclusive gift box. Maybe I'll pick that up while we're out there.
There you go. All right. Well, thank you so much for sending us Owl Post. These were both great. Love hearing from all of you. All right. So now our main discussion. We said we would be having someone else join us, and now is the time.
A couple of months ago, Amy and I had the opportunity to interview Robin Guyver, who is one of the puppeteers on the Fantastic Beasts. He was on the first two, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So he worked on the Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them and Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald. And he is a sheer delight. So we hope you all enjoy this interview that we were so lucky that he was able to take the time to talk to us.
Yes. And just a little disclaimer that we did record this prior to Secrets of Dumbledore being released. So in case there's some strange moments where we say things like, oh, we don't know and we haven't seen the movie, that's why.
I promise you, I have seen the movie at this point.
Yes. All right. So take a little trip back in time with us. So our main discussion today is really just a very special Nomad Movie Magic segment. And we have a special guest with us today for this segment, Robin Guyver. Am I saying your name right?
Yes, that's perfect. That's correct. Okay. Well done.
All right. So Robin was the supervising creature puppeteer for the first two Fantastic Beasts films. Mm-hmm. And we previously featured Robin and his crew of puppeteers on episode 132. So if you missed that, check it out. Robin, I just wanted to have you introduce yourself to our listeners. Mm-hmm. What do you do? Where are you from? How did you get into this?
Sure. It's a pleasure. Well, thank you so much for having me on. So my name is Robin Guyver, and yeah, I'm an actor and I'm a puppeteer, and I'm from England. I grew up in London, and I've somehow accidentally ended up working with all these kind of bizarre, strange creatures and animals and monsters and beasts through kind of a very, very odd kind of career path I never would have imagined possible, really. But yeah. I guess I started out as trying to be an actor as a kid, doing youth theatre and working with community theatre and really enjoying storytelling and cinema and going to see plays, and then kind of decided, yeah, that's it, that's what I want to do, I want to perform and then, you know, do amazing kind of things. But I never would have imagined kind of where I've ended up now.
Yeah. That's awesome. We have to ask, what's your Hogwarts house? Mm.
It is Hufflepuff. Yes. But it seems to be everyone. Wow. I know seems to be Hufflepuff, or certainly everyone I know who works in film and theatre.
Yeah.
Who I work with seems to be. Yeah. But yeah, it's good.
Hufflepuff is very popular these days because of Mr. Scamander.
Yeah, I feel like I'm outnumbered on this call now. I'm a little uncomfortable.
Oh, what are you guys?
Also Hufflepuff.
I'm a Slytherin.
The best.
Mm-hmm. Ah, very good. Well, there's the whole misconception that Slytherin is evil. It's ambitious and excited and, you know, like,
right,
dedicated.
Right, right. We'll call it ambitious and dedicated, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Robin, can you explain a little bit about what you did on the first two films?
Absolutely. It all came to me as a massive surprise, honestly, because I spent a long, long time working in theatre, doing all kinds of weird and wonderful performance, and I trained in mask and mime and kind of very, very uncool forms of theatre at the time, and kind of, toured the country, sometimes to very small audiences indeed, doing very strange, incomprehensible work. but I ended up kind of, over time, finding my way through the world of movement performers to work on the stage show of Warhorse as it was moving in from the National Theatre in London to the West End, and kind of really got a deep relationship with puppetry working through that, with Hans Ring Puppet Company and with the other puppeteers, and kind of doing the show for about 2.5 years. So really going from, you know, you do a show for 2 months, 5 months maybe at most, to like really having done it well over 500 times.
And, wow.
Which is a very bizarre experience as a performer, quite often, especially in film. You do a scene once and it's done, you never touch it again. Mm-hmm. But in theatre, we repeat it and repeat it and repeat it, and finding those tricks to make it fresh and exciting and new was challenging but really fascinating as well. Mm. But then through that work with puppetry, I was then invited by a colleague of mine, a guy who had started a theatre company I used to write about at university called Gecko Theatre. Alan Najari invited me to come and do some work on a film which turned out to be set in zero gravity in space on the International Space Station. We were kind of helping the stunt team on wires move people around. And we essentially were moving Sandra Bullock and George Clooney in the film called Gravity. And you know, not to take anything away from the work they did, their performances were incredible. But we were just facilitating that sense of weightlessness and movement with the special effects team, with the amazing stunts team that were there as well, and just to really help that. And that's my first time on a film set, which I don't know if you guys have ever spent any time on a set, but it's a very it's not what you would expect at all. We're in these kind of particularly then we're in these dusty warehouses, which were kind of big empty rooms with lots of kind of polystyrene cutout sets that were then animated over later, and it was the most unglamorous thing I think I'd ever done, but it was amazing, and watching the camera teams and the animators work really just blew my mind. But it was the relationships from that film that the first AD who worked on that, who then eventually invited me to come along and meet David Yates when he was working on Fantastic Beasts. So, well, I think quite late in the process, in the first one, they realised, are we going to have actors pretending to be the creatures? Are they going to stand there and say, and kind of be them? And I think Josh Robertson, the first AD, said, well, I've worked with these interesting puppeteers on Gravity. Maybe we should get one in. And I came in and had a chat with David and talked about kind of the work we've done on War Horse and our approach to puppetry being very much like the approaching a role, kind of looking at kind of researching and understanding where a character's coming from and bringing that through movement to bringing puppet characters to life. And he seemed to be really interested in that, and he invited the animators in and kind of from there went, well, okay, let's try this and see what happens. That was a very long-winded way around to that, but it was a very kind of unique and accidental and very fortunate set of events that found me kind of in that room on that particular day.
It's so cool because there are so many different roles on a film mm-hmm. set, like you're saying, mm-hmm. you know, that people don't even realize are mm-hmm. there to make this end product. And I guess watching these films, you wouldn't think about the actors who stood in for the different mm-hmm. beasts. Mm-hmm. So what of the creatures did you stand in for, and you know, which ones did have to be acted out on the set?
I remember the very first two we really did a lot of work with were, because they were coming up quite early in the schedule, I think, and also mm. they had quite kind of important scenes, were the Niffler. And the very first thing I think we did, they built the shop front from the first Fantastic Beasts film out of cardboard boxes in a space.
Oh my gosh!
Kind of just to test it out so that stunt performers could go, maybe there's a chandelier here and we can swing on that.
That's the best scene. I love that scene.
It's amazing. But it started from this kind of this set of cardboard boxes that were stacked up, and they brought in a clown to talk about physical comedy and movement. And then we had this I think almost like beanbag style Niffler first, very, very simple, based on Pablo Grillo, the animation director's kind of designs that he'd done. And just moving this little thing around so it could kind of look, stop and freeze, and then kind of get a little look to mute. And then react. And so he had something real to look at and interact with. And David was very clear. He really knew what he wanted that interaction to be, like that kind of wordless silent comedy. And that he would say, just look at him like this, do a really slow look, and then go. And then, so yeah, David really kind of understood the character as a director as well. But then we just played out that scene and tried it out, and it seemed really entertaining. So that was the first part of the Niffler. And we mm-hmm. put this beanbag Niffler on the end of a stick and kind of move it around very fast like that. We'd hold it and do slightly more nuanced performances with it. And another puppeteer came in, Avi Leventis, who did a kind of hand puppeted version as well, which was wonderful. Just exploring how this thing might move and where, how big it might be on set, and you know, if it's running along things in the bank and things like that.
Oh my gosh.
And the animators had absolutely kind of designed the character in advance. And the process of the film was animation teams designed the characters, and then we would build something based on that, which then Eddie could then interact with. And he really loved having something real there, rather than kind of a tennis ball on a stick, and then going, oh, well, if I'd known it was that big, I wouldn't have done this or that. He'd go, oh, no, actually, let's work out this interaction. Because the other character we started working with was Pickett. And we just had this little kind of wire version of him that one of the model makers had made out of wire based on designs that really didn't move, didn't do anything. We just kind of held it there like a little pencil. But just moving it around. And then we had this really kind of entertaining exercise where we tried to go, well, what if you could talk, you know? And he said, oh, well, come on. I said, I don't want to. So why not? Well, the others have been bullying me. And we kind of just made up this kind of bizarre improvisation. But the relationship kind of developed a bit from those kind of very first days playing around with ideas. They let Eddie explore things and make decisions about his character. And it was kind of very, very bizarre, but fun and playful and we were finding these things as we went along a lot of the time.
That is so amazing. I love that. That they let you have that much input into the characters. Is that like normal that you create the characters like that?
The characters were designed very much, and their personalities were very much suggested and given through the script. But then I think it was then having the opportunity to explore those with Eddie, and letting him kind of go, what is new to relationship? And he had a very strong idea as well. I was like, well, what if he's like this, or what if I kind of do this with my hands and he can kind of walk along them? And so he brought all of these ideas with him as well. So I don't want to lay claim on any of the kind of creative side. It was purely just turning up and being playful with what they gave us was what we got to do.
Very cool. So what is the process when you're trying to figure out how to simulate these different creatures that are not real creatures? How do you research that and figure out what to do?
There's a few different places we can start. I mean, obviously the script will sometimes very explicitly tell us about the characters and their interactions, or sometimes less explicitly, but through the stage directions they're given, you can kind of understand, oh, he's being shy, or it's angry, or it's the Thunderbird is very proud in this moment. Yeah. Kind of, but then also, once there was a design for the character, we'd look at kind of animals who were in a similar world. So obviously we looked at like eagles for the Thunderbird and how they move and things like that. We looked at moles and hamsters and things like that before we talk about the Niffler. And kind of tried to draw as much from real life as well. So the Arumpant was a great example of that, because it's this enormous fantastical creature. But then we looked at rhinos and elephants and hippos and the different movements these very big creatures had and how they interacted with the world around them. And that gave us a really good starting point for exploring how something like that might move and the speed it might be able to move at. And whilst we didn't puppeteer every single part of the Rumpants scenes, just because it's enormous, the scene where Newt kind of discovers it in the zoo and performs his mating ritual with it, we absolutely had this enormous, 3 meter by 5 meter puppet. And it wasn't even, I say puppet, it was like a frame, like almost like a wicker bar, not even a wicker basket, but just a frame that gave us the size of it, and a head that had a big horn coming off the top. That really let everyone see, especially the camera team see, wow, this thing, that if it's in the frame, we've got to leave this much space for it. And it really makes Newt look very small in comparison. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that we definitely kind of went back to real life, going, how do these things move? And how long does it take them to turn around rather than...
Mm-hmm. That's hilarious to picture, because we've all heard Eddie talk about how awkward that was to do on set. Now just picturing this big like wicker basket Arumpant that he's performing it to just makes it even better.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, because when we first started, I did wonder, God, is Eddie going to hate working with puppets? I just had no idea. And so I had a friend of mine who has some puppet rhinos he uses for a street theatre performance. They're these rhino heads with these bodies that can run around with and cause chaos at street theatre festivals. And so we hired one of those in and we brought it in. And I just put this big rhino head on a stick, and it was nowhere big enough, but just kind of tried playing out the scene with this head on a stick. And it was really successful and interesting and really good fun to kind of, just as a first chance, to go, is this going to work at all? And we went, yeah, okay, yeah, that's it's playful and fun and we've got somewhere. So let's keep pushing and build these things and see how they go.
That's amazing.
Wow.
I mean, I do have such wonderful memories of working that project. So I was learning so much as well, because I hadn't spent much time on film sets at that point in my life. And there was a really supportive crew who you know, kind of would help me out when I didn't know what was going on. but it was a great experience.
That's awesome. About how many people were on your team? Were there a lot of puppeteers and movement actors?
So we didn't really have a permanent team in, but as the creatures scenes were coming up, we'd bring in the groups here and there. Sometimes there was three people in the rumpant, then I'd be on the outside of it talking to them on the radio, so they kind of knew what was going on. There were times when we did the interior casework, there was five of us there, just because we had the grap horns and then all kinds of other things, the baby Occamies and all sorts of things. We just didn't really know how many of those things would appear at any one moment as well. So a lot of the time, the way David works is he's really looking for actors to have experiences, and he's kind of working out his shots. So in the morning, he comes in and rehearses with the actors. And until he's done that rehearsal, we don't know exactly what's happening in those scenes. And so we'll often be prepared to improvise or be told, now this thing's, the Niffer's going to pick this thing up here. So can you find a way to just pick this thing up so Eddie can take it? Or when the Niffler gets picked up as well. It's very hard for an actor to mime something that's not there. So quite often we'll give him a small beanbag or something that he can really hold and feel real weight, but also so that his hand has something real in it, that he's not kind of having to kind of keep really rigid, that he can really hold. Yeah. So the animators then have something to actually build on top of it. In fact, I do remember when we were in the bank vaults, he picks up the Niffler by its legs and shakes it. To help the animation team, we made this kind of strange beanbag that had two little feet sticking out the top of it that Eddie could pick up and shake up and down. It was the most kind of ridiculous thing, like a tiny little black turkey. But yes, then we picked it up and shook it. But then it gave the animators something very real to build the rest of the Niffler's body off, but keep Eddie's interaction with that thing feeling very authentic and real.
Wow. So cool. I love
it's so bizarre. I mean, you wouldn't believe how ridiculous some of the things are when you see them, but trying to bring to life these little objects and have real interactions and genuine kind of emotional investment in these things. I mean, Eddie's an absolute genius in terms of the way his performance as well. He really does invest 110% in his work and really, really wants it to be believable and real and truthful. And that really shows, I think.
Yeah. I mean,
definitely.
That's why we all connect with it afterwards. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, awesome. Did you have a favorite creature to simulate?
Ooh. I mean, I think I have a favorite creature. I mean, watching the films, I think you can't help but fall in love with the Niffler. They're wonderful. Mm-hmm. They're really. But in terms of the performance side, I really enjoyed doing the Thunderbird, because it was just a simple 3D printed head that we put some handles onto. So it was really, there was nothing, no moving parts, nothing at all. But it was enough just to kind of try and bring this thing to life and move it around and imagine that it's looking at things and coming in, coming out. And it felt like that was a really interesting interaction, even though it's a very brief moment in the film. But that interaction felt really, really interesting and authentic and fun to do.
Wow.
So what I'm getting from all this, Robin, is that you've played more characters than Warwick Davies in the Harry Potter series.
Well, I definitely wouldn't say that to Warwick. I mean, I have helped create... I mean, I guess I've helped in the kind of realization of them, but I mean, they're also huge animation teams who have put their hearts and souls and hours and hours and hours of their lives into them as well, in designing them and then in animating them afterwards as well. So it's a great privilege to be part of that team. But I really, I have to give hats off to the animation team who do such hard work on it as well. It's a real pleasure. So I'm a small part of these wonderful characters, but I get to do quite a fun part to it.
So as far as like the puppets themselves, does like the props department come up to you with a 3D printed Thunderbird head and say, here you go? Or is there any part of it that you're responsible for? Or is it just provided to you by the props department generally?
That's a great question. I guess the process starts from once we look at the script and go, oh, here's an interaction. The visual effects supervisors, which were Tim Burke and Christian Manns on those two films, both came along and would say, well, here's an interaction we think that is going to pick up this creature or touch this creature. So we need something real for that. So whether we need, is a small creature, we need something real he can pick up and touch. Is a big creature, we need something, whether it's the flank of the puppeteer's shoulder, or is it actually something real that we've got that has more mass to it that he can interact with. So, but if there's physical contact, then that's where we need something got there. But then also if it's something that's very, very tall, like the Occamy, okay, then maybe we need a head. But if it's not being touched, it doesn't have to be exactly the right... it doesn't have to look perfect, but it needs to be about the right size so camera knows how big it is. Or if it's about kind of much more emotional interaction, then actually let's get it to look quite a lot like the creature. But then really we just need the head. And when actors interact with puppets quite often, if we invest a lot of time in their eyes, and certainly the actors who worked in Warhorse were interacting with the puppets, we always said this, that the horse's eyes were really effective because they were given this kind of back painted effect on them. They felt really believable, they caught the light. And so if that has got something that's got realistic, believable eyes that they can look at, that's probably enough. Just a head with some interesting eyes to focus on, and their imagination can fill in all of the rest. So it's really about what is the interaction in that scene? Is it about an emotional interaction? Is it about a physical interaction? If it's a fight like that, then actually the stunt department will come in and they'll go, okay, so if he needs to hit this thing, then perhaps we need to have something soft on the end of a stick that can move in, or if it needs to be, it needs to jump out of the way, do we need to be able to swing something towards him, or have one of our stunt performers in a green suit or something so they can act out the character with their own body as well. So it's breaking down what we think those interactions are and then building to that. But the prop making department did wonderful work with the prints, the designs of some very large creatures like the Arumpant as well. And then there's a kind of a lengthy R&D process where we're trying them out, going, oh, this works, or that's quite tricky. Okay, this film's in about a week, so maybe we should change this bit or that bit. Is it going to fit on set? I'm not sure. Let's go and find out.
Wow, so it sounds like really everyone's involved. Like every department's kind of in on this process of creating the creatures.
Absolutely. That's one of the amazing things about the filmmaking process is it's so collaborative and it brings in all the different parts. And if there's a creature that glows, for example, I can't remember if we had any on this one, but then the electricians will need to actually create something that glows so that there's the real interactive lighting on the actors' hands or on their faces and things like that as well.
Okay.
I mean, and one of the other things that we do is even if we haven't built a puppet for something, but if there's something that's there, we need to help people look in the right place. If there's one actor looking at something, then they can look where they want, they can animate what they want. As soon as there's two or more people looking at something that's not there, and they're looking in two different places, you really see that on film. And so those eye lines, whether they're off the camera or not, become really important. So it might be, if there's a niffler running across us, we might have to have, and we can't get into the shot, we might have to have a laser pen, a little laser dot like you, kind of your cat would chase around. We use that and go, it's going there, and everyone looks there. Or we might have a big X on a stick if it's, you know, you've got 100 people in the crowd all looking up at something, and then we'll have a big X on a stick. And I remember when they were shooting Newt walking out of the case in the courtroom. This is the first time I ever really had to do this. They're going, oh, well, we can't put Newt there because there's no hole in the floor. So we're going to imagine that he's walking out and then they'll put him in later using visual effects. But everyone needs to look there. So I wonder if we could put like a tennis ball on the end of a string and you can pull it up and they can watch it go up. And so I remember sitting down in front of, you know, about 100 extras and, you know, the crew of about 50 people in that room, and then much larger crew out there going, okay, well, how am I going to attach this? And like trying to tie some string up quickly, put it at the end of a fishing pole. I mean, and now that's sort of my bread and butter. That's part of my work. I know how to do it. At the time, I was kind of going, oh my God, everyone's waiting for me as I'm trying to wave this tennis ball around. It's sort of swinging around and crazy. But having people look in a believable place so they can put the animation in later became a really big part of that storytelling as well, so that it was believable. Yeah.
So you had said that these were kind of some of the first films that you worked on. That's a big thing to walk into a Wizarding World film as like some of your first ones, right?
I mean, it was enormous. I think I'd done Gravity before that, and maybe done a little bit here and there on some other ones. I'd been a dancer on one of the Muppets films and done a tiny, like, one day puppet show on it, which was a dream come true for me as someone who'd done a lot of work and grown up loving puppets. I think I'd done a little bit on the first Star Wars by that point. But nevertheless, this was a much more involved in relationship with the crew and with the story. And this was, and you know, there's a lot, I really having to make a lot of stuff up as I went along, I think. But I sort of realised that a lot of filmmaking is that you're problem solving as you go, and you have the right people there with the right skill sets to build things and prepare things. It's different if it's a dance number or a fight that needs to be rehearsed and choreographed. But then a lot of time David would go, oh, well, what if this happened in this scene and that happened in that? And so then the visual effects supervisor Tim would come along and go, oh, maybe we can make this thing go on a magnet that can do this, and we'd be building these strange little kind of rigs to kind of make these magical effects happen one way or another. And the special effects department obviously did amazing work with all sorts of things happening in camera as well as the animation. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was, and watching all these other people do their jobs that they've been doing for years. I mean, the Harry Potter films really did such a good thing for the British film industry. I think so many people kind of worked on them over years and years and years and were able to go up from the beginning of their careers to being so experienced over those seven films. Mm-hmm. And I work with people who've done them today who are now at the top of their game. And yeah, it's kind of great getting to see everyone do such amazing work. Mm-hmm.
Wow. So cool. Mm. Love hearing all the stories from set. Were there any particular creatures that posed some issues for you? You know, you talk about trying to MacGyver together a bunch of stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Was there anything particularly challenging?
I don't think it made it in the end, but there was a section inside the case, inside the world in the case, which was like a darker cave area. I mean, I feel like the kind of a version of it got onto YouTube at one point. I'm not sure if it's still there or not. Wow. But where they went to these caves and there was this, gosh, I can't remember what it's called, this thing like this kind of flying blankets.
What
it's called now.
Oh, was it Swooping Evil?
It wasn't the Swooping
Evil. The Lethafold.
That's it. And so we were sort of like, well, look, we don't really have time to build something really, really, really clever. And the budget's very tight now at the moment towards the end of the film. This was the last things we were filming. So I kind of made this thing out of a big bit of black cloth with like kind of some wire and two sticks that was sort of like a sort of gymnastics ribbon, really, like a very big gymnastics ribbon that I could kind of fly around and wave around. It could kind of swoop up and appear and then swoop away and disappear again. We never shot it in the end, because I think it's the sequence changed from the original conception of it. But it took me so long to kind of work out how on earth to do this thing sat in this kind of little office in Leeson Studios, kind of filming myself on my phone going, what if it does this? No. What if it's done that? And the wire wasn't strong enough, so it kept bending. So I could do it stronger. And I didn't know where to source a lot of my equipment at that point as well. So I was kind of going, oh, can I borrow this and that from other departments? So, oh, yeah. But yeah, so it's a lot of do-it-yourself puppet making at the time. So, because I'm really not a puppet maker, I'm a puppeteer, and I perform and love the character side of it. And there are people who really excel at making the puppet side of things as well. So that was out of my wheelhouse, definitely.
Oh, I wish that our host Shannon was here. She was very upset that the Lethafold never made it in the film.
Yeah.
Oh, no. I mean, it was definitely there. There was a previs of it. And
We'll have to tell her.
There we go.
So moving back, you mentioned that you had some experience doing Force Awakens by this point when you did Fantastic Beasts. So you puppeteered Dio in Rise of Skywalker.
Yes.
How is puppeteering a droid different from a beast, or is there a difference? Like, what challenges does that present versus an organic creature?
I mean, in some ways it's similar. In some ways, it is night and day different. I mean, a character like Dio was a team of us. Sometimes in the frames Dio is animated, but a lot of the time, the majority of the time, I believe, was the puppeteered versions. But I was not on my own by any means. I had a Rodan was moving the body around, or occasionally a remote control. But then my colleague Lynn was working the animatronic controls to move the head as well. So we would always be at least two of us involved in that. But then the team of droid builders who work for Neil Scanlon's kind of creature shop are absolute geniuses. You know, I'm pretty sure one of them is a Guinness World Record holder for having built an amazing kind of robot that he can ride and drive around, Matt Denton. But the entire team are absolute geniuses. And the work they do in terms of building the puppets, we just get to play with them. They're there doing the software engineering, the electrical engineering, the programming side of building real robots for us to play with, really. But the difference there is that with an animated character, you can have something very simple and get across a lot of emotion and intention just through very simple movement. And then the animations will be placed on top of that, or you'll shoot, then take it away and shoot it without that, and they'll put the animated version in. But with the animatronic versions that Neil Scanlan's team did for the Star Wars films, that's all in camera. So the eye movements, the mouth movements, the actual creature suits themselves are real. They're there on set. The actors can see them. They have to get moved around. I think it was the Happabor, I think. Yes, it must have been the Happabor. We were in this enormous creature that's drinking at a water trough. Had to be craned in on a big Manitou into the desert in Abu Dhabi, where we were shooting. And then we had to get inside, like five of us had to get inside it, and then there were others on the outside controlling the eye mechanisms and the things like that. And every now and again, maybe the visual effects team will add a little something like a blink here or there, but as much as possible, that work is done in camera for real, so that it's really there on set. And to a certain extent, that's the kind of puppetry I fell in love with, watching things like Labyrinth all of the work the Jim Henson's Creature Shop that did kind of early on. I grew up watching all of that, and it just absolutely blew my mind. And so to get to work on those kind of films as well was such a pleasure. And it's a very different challenge, because what you see on camera is what you're going to see in the film. Mm-hmm. They'll do some color grading, obviously they'll edit it, but your timing has to be right. Your intention has to be right. The angle of the head, if it looks like this, then it looks sad. If it looks like that, then it looks inquisitive. And you've got to hit the right emotion on camera every time. There's not time to do it loads and loads of times over and over again. And so that's really about precision performance of a team of people. So it's very rarely it's just one person. Whereas the work in the Beasts films is really about much more about the emotional interaction between an actor and a character. And then the details are then, and the beautiful movement and the beautiful look of the creatures is all then brought in by the animation team afterwards. But you're really looking for what is underneath that in terms of the relationship and kind of to capture that on set for the actors and for the crew as well, so they understand the story and they know what they're filming. That it's just not, rather than just an empty kind of scene with the actor and nothing there. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it's two very different challenges and both rewarding in very different ways.
On your website, you mm-hmm. mentioned that you like tabletop gaming.
Oh, yes, massively, yes.
What Fantastic Beasts would you like to have as your familiar in a campaign?
Oh, my goodness. probably one I could ride on. yes. Maybe like a Zawu would be quite amazing.
Oh, my God, that would be amazing.
Or if it had to be something small, then it would be lovely to have a Niffler to go and pick locks or kind of gather information and things like that and bring things back. But then you'd always be chasing him because he'd never give you the gold in the end. Is that a pastime you guys enjoy?
I play D&D. Amy, I don't know Fantastic. If you, that's your thing.
I don't, but Anne asks everyone some version of this question. Sure. I always wait for it every interview.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I mean, what I love about it is, I think certainly in my life, a big theme is like, I love imaginary worlds. Mm-hmm. And whether that's playing a game with a small group of friends around a table, or it's watching a film with a world that just you feel completely immersed in, or reading a book or a series of books that you feel like you can really inhabit that world, but also at the same time that world is then helping us understand our own world in a deeper, more meaningful way as well. And so I think imaginary worlds and storytelling is such a fundamental part of human communities. I think it's I love it. I get really, really excited about kind of all sorts of magical, fantastical, imaginary experiences in the world. They're very good for us. Yes, I'm an advocate for them, definitely.
Yes.
So you have hit most of the big nerd points here. You've got Star Wars, you've got Muppets, you've got Doctor Who, you've got Harry Potter. Do you have any projects that upcoming projects you'd like to talk about, or that you can talk about?
I mean, it's very difficult to talk about upcoming projects that I'm actually all definitely engaged in. I mean, I've always dreamed since I was a little boy of doing a James Bond film, but there's no puppets and creatures in James Bond films, so I guess I don't know how that will manifest, but maybe one day. But just I always grew up watching them and enjoying that. So, goodness, other upcoming projects. I can't. I don't know. I don't know. There's definitely upcoming projects though.
Excellent.
Yes, there will be more, definitely. And I know I have a lovely group of friends who all worked on the most recent Fantastic Beasts film, which I'm really looking forward to seeing. And so, and they certainly had some very interesting creatures to work on, some of which we haven't met before. So,
yeah. Yes.
I'm dying because. There's so you much I want to say, but I can't.
I don't get to see it until Thursday. So.
I know. Sad. So where can our listeners find you on social? Do you have it, like Insta, Facebook?
I have Instagram at Robin Guyver and Twitter at Robin Guyver. It's all gone very quiet at the moment, so I'm working on a project I can't talk about. but I've got my website, www.robinguyver.co.uk. And we've got a new website for our company that does the visual effects reference puppetry that we put up recently, which is www.pfx, which stands for Performance Effects Film. So www.pfxfilm.com. And that's actually got lots of our images from behind the scenes on Fantastic Beasts that Warner Brothers very kindly gave us permission to put up there. So if you're interested, go and have a look at them. You may have seen some of them before, but yeah, that's where we put all that stuff too.
Very great. Cool. Thank you. We'll be sure to plug those in our show notes. That way our listeners can check out all your hard work.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic. Good. Oh, well, I'm glad people enjoy it. That's the important thing, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Oh, I feel very grateful that I've been on and got to chat to you guys about it. I really enjoy talking about it. So yes, I'm so glad that you guys are kind of curious and excited about the new film as well. So am I.
Oh yeah. Yeah, we'll have to. We'll send you that episode when it comes out, and you'll have Please to tell do. Us when you've seen the new movie what mm-hmm. you think.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, you can get all the new creatures.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, there's lots I don't know about it as well in this one, so that's quite exciting to get to see it as an audience member too.
Yeah.
I'm dying.
Oh, well, guys, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure talking to you both. And, yes. Yeah, and keep up the good work.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Cheers.
All right, so we hope that you enjoyed hearing that interview with Robin as much as we enjoyed talking with him. It was really, really fascinating to learn so much about the creative process and the behind-the-scenes information on how these creatures get translated to the screen.
What a blast. He was such a delightful human being.
Really, truly was. So since Robin worked on the first two films, but not on Secrets of Dumbledore, he wasn't able to give us insight into some of the creatures for the third film. So we wanted to ask you all for our podcast question, is there a creature from Secrets of Dumbledore that you would like to know the creative process behind? If so, drop us an owl, and you can do that on any of our social media outlets or email us at speakbeastie@gmail.com. You can also leave us a review on Apple Podcasts.
And while you are out and about on the internet, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at speakbeastie, on Facebook at facebook.com/speakbeastie, on Tumblr at speakbeastiepodcast.tumblr.com. You can support the show on Patreon at patreon.com/speakbeastie. There is a lot of really good content that just came out. Jeff and their wife just did a really fun extra where they create like K-pop playlists for Ooh, each of the characters.
That's fun.
Yeah, it's super fun. And I'm currently doing a series where I take my... God, let me think. I got it when Deathly Hallows came out. So that was like 2007. So I take my 15-year-old Harry Potter 20 questions toy and I answer questions about a Fantastic Beasts character to find out who their analog is in the original Harry Potter series. And it has been wild so far. Amy, do you have anything cool coming up?
I am planning to do a live stream at some point this week. When I nail down a time, we'll put that out on our socials so you all will be able to tune in and I'll just chat with you. I'll probably do some color in some of those great sheets that our graphic designer Carolyn has been uploading to Patreon for us, and just talk with you all. So if you have any burning questions, hopefully I can answer them. We'll see.
Yeah, this just makes me think about when Jennifer and Marjo used to do their crafting on mm-hmm. Instagram Live. Maybe I'll stir that up again. That would I have so many cross stitches, and I'm sure people are thirsty to watch me do needlework.
I mean, you still have to start the Dangerous Times Favorite Dangerous Men. I do
need to do that. So. Once I finish with my London cross stitch for our travel wall, I will get on that. She lied. That wraps up the show. Thank you all so much for sticking around with us.
I'm Amy.
I'm Anne. Case closed.